Jazz pianist Marion McPartland will celebrate her 90th birthday next week. She'll perform with her trio at Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola at Jazz at Lincoln Center on March 19th. She also has a new CD titled Twilight World. McPartland is one of the few women instrumentalists of her generation who made it in the jazz world. She made her mark not only as a musician, but as the host of the NPR series Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz. She's now in her 29th year as host. McPartland grew up in England and moved to America after marrying Chicago cornetist Jimmy McPartland. They met during World War II while they were each performing for the troops. Jimmy McPartland died in 1991. Terry spoke with Marion McPartland in 1987. She grew up in a proper upper-middle-class home, where classical music was appreciated, while jazz was heartily disapproved of. Her mother thought that playing jazz was a path to depravity. So McPartland took classical piano lessons at the Guildhall School of Music and developed a secret interest in jazz.
When I was studying, the professor I had there was a very wonderful guy, very solemn, but very much against jazz. And at that time, I was really into learning all kinds of jazz from records. And I would be supposed to be practicing, but I would be playing something by Art Tatum or trying to perfect an Art Tatum run or something. And he opened the door one time and said, got very red in the face, "Stop playing that trash!" So I'm afraid there's probably still a few people that feel that way, but not as much as they did at that time. But it really wasn't long after that that I left and took off with a four-piano act. That was my first introduction to not so much the jazz life, but the show business life. And actually, now I'm rather proud of having worked in all those vaudeville theaters because they're very historical places, those of them that are still standing.
I think your entry into the jazz life came during World War II when you were playing for the troops and playing a lot of jazz. Were you considered something of a freak being a woman jazz musician?
No, I don't think so, Terry. Because when I went to France and played in a group for the armed forces, that really wasn't jazz. That was sort of showbiz again. And then actually after I met Jimmy, I guess that's when I feel that I really got into playing a little more actual jazz. But then when I came here to the States and got to hear all the people in person that I had loved for so long on records, like Duke Ellington and Fats Waller, James P. Johnson, Art Tatum, Teddy Wilson, all those people, then a lot of it did start to sort of rub off on me, and I became a better player because of hearing all these people, and of course because of Jimmy, working with his group, plus the fact that Jimmy was very helpful. He was always very helpful and very admiring of my talent, and he was always introducing me to do solo numbers and to do numbers with the band. He seemed to be very proud of what I did. He kept saying, you ought to have your own trio and you shouldn't be working in this band. I could feel myself getting out of the Dixieland chord structure and into more modern things. And of course, I listened to everything that was going on all the time. So he really was the one that kind of sold me on the idea that I should have my own trio.
You told us a little earlier that you didn't feel that out of place being a woman early on in your jazz career, and I'll tell you, I find that hard to believe.
Well, you see, Terry, before I had gone to America, there were so many women that I had listened to who were my idols, like Hazel Scott, Mary Lou Williams, Lil Armstrong, and a woman who I've really admired a great deal, Cleo Brown. So that I didn't realize that being a woman, when I got to New York, being a woman with a jazz group, people would find it unusual because it seemed to me that there were plenty of women out there, and I still think so.
Well, I was reading a Newsweek review of your work from December 30th of 1957.
Oh, my God.
And it said that you played, quote, a romantic arrangement of On the Alamo. And then a little later, her style turned masculine and aggressive as she swung into From This Moment On. And I love that because I don't think that they would have called it a romantic arrangement if it was a man playing a ballad. And then... As it was aggressive, it turned masculine. And you must have run into that a lot.
Yeah, that it's funny because after a while, that did start to annoy me. And I would think every time that you would get a little stronger or more forceful, they didn't say that. They didn't call it strong or forceful. It was either aggressive or masculine. And so people would say to me, oh, you play just like a man. Or else they'd say, oh, you play good for a girl. And after a while, in the beginning, I sort of took everything as a compliment. But then I would think, well, why does it have to be aggressive? I don't like that word. It just makes me feel so that I'm sort of hunching my shoulders and punching the piano. You know, why does it have to be aggressive? Why can't it just be with more strength or more a more forceful player? So gradually over the years, I think all that stuff has changed. I've noticed nobody says that anymore.
Right. Did you feel initially uncomfortable in the jazz life as an upper-middle-class British woman? Were you made to feel uncomfortable by that? Did you try to...
You mean to get down and to be one of the boys?
Right, exactly. Right. Well, a lot of people go through this, you know, that they're just a little embarrassed about their proper upbringing and they try to be more... Yeah, more down or more bohemian or whatever.
No, I think I was always myself in that regard. In fact, but people used to kid me either about my accent. But I really was one of the group. I mean, I wasn't somebody that sort of was a snob. I think, I mean, although I came, I feel that my family was snobs. My mother was very careful about, she didn't let me mingle with certain kinds of people. Well, that's why they were so upset about me being in the music business, because they felt that everybody in music had to be weird or a bohemian or strange. You know, some of the strangest people I've ever met have had nothing to do with music. I think musicians, for the most part, are a very normal lot of people, and certainly more fun. And they a musician is something really extra special. Different from other people in a good way. I don't know how to explain it.
You've, as a musician, had to be on the road a lot during your life. You've been lucky enough to have very long stays at certain clubs like the Cafe
sure
Carlisle
have.
In New
yeah.
York and the Hickory House
yeah.
In New York. But I think life on the road is the downfall of a lot of performers, and it's in part how they end up on drugs or alcohol. Was it hard to not give in to temptations like that, especially probably with some of the, not peer pressure exactly, but when you're hanging out with people and everybody's going drinking after the set, you know?
Oh, I had my share of drinks, but I never, I always had that feeling about, like, years ago when we used to be hanging out in pubs in England, it was always that, you know, you're supposed to be able to drink and hold it. You're not supposed to get drunk. You know, it's sort of undignified and terrible, undignified thing to do. So I could never, ever see myself getting out of control. I mean, I used to like to have drinks at the Hickory House. In fact, I used to like to pour a straight shot when nobody was looking. I thought I was really getting back at the owner. I would get one of the bottles. You know, we were surrounded by bottles on the bandstand. And when nobody was looking, I would pour myself a shot and drink it, you know, and sort of one up for me. But as far as pot or any of the other things, I wouldn't do that to myself. I mean, I did smoke a little pot, but just once or twice. But it never affected me in a good way. And a bass player once said to me, oh, but Marion, you really have to learn how to handle that. You have to get used to being able to handle it. I said, well, if I have to do that, then I don't want to do it. And I've never done anything that would get in the way of playing, although I can see how that would be a hang-up for some people, because I think one has that feeling of wanting to be on top and be the best you can possibly be every night. And that if you take something that's going to help you be that way, temptation is to be wanting to do that every night.
You know, your career has had an interesting graph to it. A lot of musicians start their careers, well, early on in their lives, become very well known for a certain style, for a certain recording, and then they reach a peak early on, and it's kind of, in the public eye, it's kind of downhill from there. And I think with your career, it's been exactly the opposite. It's been this slow, upward
it's amazing,
rise, and every year you become better known, and I think your playing becomes more beautiful, and I think it's an unusual twist on the typical career.
It's funny. I think, well, I just feel as if everything I've done has been a sort of a springboard to do something else, and I like to set goals for myself and always have something new to do. And I also have this feeling that one, you're supposed to improve as you learn more, that you're supposed to get better. I feel as if I know more, I should be able to play more, and I'm always trying to eliminate bad things about my playing. And it's just that feeling. I think, well, you should be able to do better, you should be able to play better, you should be able to write more. And so far, I've been lucky. That's the way it's gone.
This also brings to mind a very nice quote from Mary Lou Williams that's in one of the profiles in your new book. And she says, anything you are shows up in your music.
Yeah, isn't that a great thing?
I do like that quote, yeah, a lot. It seems to me that cuts both ways, though.
You know? Probably does.
The wisdom of your life is reflected in your music. But if you're really in a real rut emotionally, that could come out in your music, too.
Yeah, I'm sure it could. I mean, I don't want to drop any names, but I can think of some people years ago that I felt that about, that they would reach a certain level. And I guess the temptation is, if you're very well known, is to reach a certain level and then coast on what you had. And you sort of think, well, I don't have to do any better. But I think maybe that's the way I've always been brought up, that you're supposed to always do your best and try hard and don't give up. And there's this saying about, I forget who said this, but that when you sit down to play, you should play as if it were the last day of your life. Play as well as you can, because it may be the last chance you have to play. And I think a lot of us do feel that way.
Terry Gross spoke with Marion McPartland in 1987. She celebrates her 90th birthday next week. She'll perform with her trio at Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola at Jazz at Lincoln Center on March 19th. She also has a new CD titled Twilight World.